You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I am talking to Lee Kyle, one of the North East's best kept comedy secrets and a pivotal figure in Felt Nowt, which is a kind of northeastern comedy cooperative. I'm going to call it an incubator, despite it sort of not being that, but it's definitely worth hearing about. He's going to tell us a bit about that. But first, we are going to talk about this dimpled diamond with a twinkly warmth and bucket loads of swearing, as I've very pleasingly written in the blurbs. We're going to talk about ADHD, focusing on multiple projects and thriving in chaos, plus all the downsides, the self-doubt, demotivation, and so on. And we're going to find out why the first minute of Lee's set is purposefully a write-off. Really, really fun. And I highly recommend Lee's show. He's doing an Edinburgh show called... it's called England's Best Comedian. We'll talk about that title. You can get tickets for that in the show notes here or at edfringe.com. And you can also find his new special, Disco Twix, on YouTube, which is obviously for free because it's on YouTube. And it was watching that. And specifically, and I don't think this came up in the interview, which annoys me, but it annoys me that I didn't bring it up. But the reason I watched it was because Lee created a little JPEG saying, hey, my friend comedian Lee Kyle has released a special and you should listen to it. And you should watch it on YouTube for free. I probably haven't been bothered to, so I can't comment on it. It said that in the thing, so it made it extremely shareable. And then that made me laugh so much, I thought, oh, God, I will check that out. And I was being very middle-aged and pressure washing the deck at the back of our house when I listened to the whole thing, because it takes ages to pressure wash a deck, much longer than I had imagined, but I kept going and did a really thorough job so I could finish the special. So Disco Twix is on YouTube, and of course there are 20 minutes of extras available exclusively to the Insiders Club from this interview. We will discuss Disco Twix in a bit more detail, wrestling with gender identity in Lee's uniquely gentle way, and we will also discover why 2002 was a great time to be a mediocre comedian. All of that and more in the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, but here is Lee Kyle. So thanks for coming on the show, Lee Kyle.
Great to see you. Thank you. I'm sorry that, I mean, I am aware that for listeners, this is a low. From the heady heights of Stuart Lee, I do apologise, everybody.
Well, let's start with that. Humility.
It's mostly fake.
I saw Disco Twix. It's a special that you put on YouTube. It's an hour and 20 minutes long. It's all
it is
funny.
Long, isn't it?
It's all funny. Lee, it's such a good show. I really enjoyed it. And part of what I enjoyed, and this is in a wider kind of context, you've been going for donkey's years. You've done loads and loads of stuff. We'll talk about Felt Nowt. We'll talk about all of your multiple projects. Apparently you did a solo performance of an entire Royal Rumble.
Oh, you're yes, I'd forgotten wrestler. About that.
I never knew. Loads of stuff to get into. But for now, for the beginning, Lee Kyle, Northeast-based, excellent comic, really, really funny. The special is called Disco Twix. It's on YouTube. You're taking a show to the Edinburgh Festival, which has another brilliant title. What's this one called?
Oh, man. It's called, I regret it now. It's called England's Best Comedian.
Thank you. Good. And you're flagging up that it's a rebrand in the blurb for the show, which I really enjoy. But all of this stuff is kind of centered around you and your personality, which I found, having never, to my chagrin, I don't think I've ever seen one of your shows live in Edinburgh. I've seen you do sets here and there. But one of your qualities, which is just magical, is how incredibly warm you are. And I think part of that is a kind of humility. Like you, not just kind of getting the knocks in at yourself first, I don't think, which is a sort of an established thing. But there is something about you. Just the audience just love you. And it's like, it's not just that you're a funny bald man. But do you know what I mean? It's like what, the notes you have, you play what you've got. You're dealing the hand that you've dealt very, very well in a way that makes people just, myself included, really roll over and like, oh, isn't Lee lovely and funny?
Okay, I think a lot of it is a genuine fear of rejection and desperation to be liked, which
possibly yes.
Which I mean, I can go on to fear of rejection later on in terms of career stuff, but I think. Oh, this sounds not even pretentious, but like I would hate somebody else for saying this, but it's genuinely my mindset at the moment, which is, so I'm in my 40s now, and assuming I live an average life, I want to be a better person in the second half of my life than in the first.
Okay.
And I don't think I've been a horrible person. I don't know. I think I'm trying to be nice, but on stage, what I am aware of is that allows me to get away with saying some things that that some people would claim you're not allowed to say these days.
Okay. Like what? Because this isn't... Well, some of the stuff I really enjoyed about your show is that it's like... I sort of described it as it's like anti-woke. Do you know what I mean? It's really pro-woke or woke, as the expression goes. Do you know what I mean? So what do you mean by saying things that you're not supposed to say?
So a lot of times you will get the differentiation between fringe shows and club sets. And people go, oh, but you couldn't do that stuff in a set. And other than in older shows where I've done some quite out there set pieces, but like in terms of stand-up, I've never found that. I've found out for whatever reason, get away with saying what I like on the whole. Luckily, what I like is, and the whole point of the show I did that was to both be as honest as I could, because I was kind of tired of pandering, not pandering, but almost. I realised one of my weaknesses is that I really, really want people to like me a lot. And what I wanted for this show was to not care about that. But luckily, I sort of got away with making them still like me because I've got dimples or whatever quality it is. In a way, I was a bit frustrated. I wanted more people to be a bit annoyed, but people just went, oh, bless, yeah. It is good that you're glad the Queen's dead.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, I don't have that thing that, although some people have hated me, but I think that's with every performer, that is obviously going to happen. But
yes.
I've got
you've used the phrase get away with about three times in the opening 4 minutes of this. Let's drill into that a bit. So do you think that it's something you're getting away with? Because you might, an outsider might look at this and go, well, this is a man who's funny and charismatic and has worked hard and written good jokes, and he's doing those jokes and he's gathering an audience and they're enjoying them. Like, what's being got away with?
I don't think I'm getting away with being a stand-up. I do think I've become good at it. And of course, that feels mortifying to say, but
of course it does. Should be a blanket waiver that over this entire podcast that says you're allowed to say, here, uniquely, you're allowed to say that you think you're good. That's fine.
Okay. But what I think I'm getting away with is being a silly, naughty boy. More than actually getting away with being able to do stand-up.
I do have confidence in
my ability to get up and do that. I do think, sadly, because, and this is one thing I often say if new acts ask my opinion, which they do because I have the outlying appearance of warmth. one of the things I always say is, if you're not going to become famous, you'd better become adaptable. And I have avoided becoming famous. So what I know is, I can play a lot of rooms or a lot of audiences that I'd rather not have had to learn to play.
Okay, yes.
And I would say that whatever, and I'm in inverted commas here, whatever charm, because I don't think it's charm, I hate that word, but whatever charm it is that sort of works for me on stage, I think has become a defence mechanism honed in places where I just want to get away with having done the job and leaving as quick as I can.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So when you're like, can you give us an example of one of those, like a gig where you've gone to war? Do you know what I mean? Where you've been like, oh, this is, I mean, have you ever played somewhere you would describe as unplayable? Because you hear the word unplayable. Yeah. Okay. So people have kind of, okay, it was unplayable. I did it. I survived. I got the money, but there was no play involved because it was unplayable. So give us your approach to that and how that, into those circumstances and how it, how that manifests in the quality that you're describing.
Okay, I can say I would play those differently now. So one of my least favourite bits of advice, which I do think it comes from, you know, that thing Gary Delaney wrote years ago that became a gospel?
Go on.
Now, and I think this is not any... I remember speaking to Gary about it, and he said, what you've got to understand, I was writing that for one specific person, giving advice on the way I do things because his act was vaguely similar.
Yeah.
But for me, the whole idea of don't waste any time, start with a quick joke, get in there hard, is absolutely nothing matter how I work.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So for me, the first minute of my set is purposely a write-off. I'm not going to waste a joke in that. Like, to me, it's all about almost, I've started to even just put it in such blank terms of going, don't worry, you're not going to enjoy the first minute, but I'm pretty good, you'll be fine. And I think that's more important to go, even if I'm not in control, because you don't always feel in control, but even if I am, I think it's important to let them have a little bit of doubt and then build it up from there and go, oh, actually, yeah, he's fine.
Yes, okay. That's interesting. That's interesting. I think like that does... Yeah, so what Gary had said is, have a quick joke, get in there, and almost like prove you're a comic. And it's what I always think of Dara O'Brien saying, the beginning 5 minutes of his tour shows is always, he calls it, trust me, I'm a comedian.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So they trust you. But what you're sort of saying is, be at peace with the fact that I'm okay with whatever happens here. And that does a similar job, doesn't it? It's not necessarily a big belting laugh, but it's the first kiss, isn't it? It's that moment where you kind of, it's the first date, you go, don't worry, everything's going to be fine in one way or another. You know, you're not saying it with a barnstorming joke, but you're kind of going, you're saying, I'm letting you into my personality.
Yeah, and I think that's it's setting the stall out, which for what Gary does is absolutely, he is going to be loads of jokes. Mm-hmm. It would be weird if he didn't start with a really strong joke. But for me, who I mean, I'm not saying I don't have one-liners, but I basically don't have one-liners.
Yeah,
it seems silly to start with a quick joke. It doesn't. And actually, my strength is that I do think I try my best to make people relax. And I feel like I try to be. I don't think I've ever phoned a set in, whether I've been good or bad. I think a lot of this is, and I know you are in a similar situation, like late realization of ADHD, you know, like
I'm gonna start ringing a bell now whenever that comes up.
And I know I'm aware of the cliche, and I'm aware that everyone's going, oh, everyone's writing about this these days, and you go, yeah, it's because we've had a lockdown, we've all realized quite how we're mental.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And
again, another disclaimer for the show, if the listener is new to this, has picked it up, ADHD is in between 5 and 8% of the population. In terms of people who, because of the way their mind works, chose to be a stand-up comic, it's more like, I mean, I revise this upwards every time, 60%.
Yeah. I've had so many people just from around here, around the Northeast, in the last 2 months go, yeah, I've got a diagnosis, so I'm going for a diet. I was speaking to Dave Haddingham 2 days ago, and he's in his 50s, and he was just like, he was talking about how Ed Byrne, you know, dropping names, had mentioned having ADHD. And Dave was like, well, that's what I do. And his wife sort of went, yes, Dave, yes, it is. And it's almost sad in a way. Like, I'm not going to, I don't know about you, but I had a vague mourning process of going, this explains why school and every job I've ever had felt impossible.
Yeah.
And it's sort of sad. But on stage, what it's meant is I'm never not in the room, and I'm very good at dipping in and out of the crowd when I feel it's necessary. And I'm very good at doing things off the cuff and using that as... using my ability to, as I quote-unquote, get away with being a little bit naughty to get away with it if ad-lib doesn't work. I'm very good at, like, this is a terrible skill that I wish I didn't have, but I'm very good at ad-libs that don't really work and then people being fine with it.
That's a great skill
I mean, it's no being able to write great routines, I'll give you that.
No, sure, for sure. Do you feel then, this is jumping ahead really, but do you feel, I'll ask you now and I'll ask you at the end maybe, do you feel you're in the appropriate place for your career?
Does anybody, honestly?
Like, I don't know. I don't think I've ever asked it before. It's a hell of a question.
The answer is, this is what I'm... So, you know, they say unhappiness, and I'm not... I know it's one of your stock questions, and it's obviously more than a yes or no question, but, you know, they say unhappiness is often based on you not being the thing you feel like you are. Mm-hmm. You're not in that position, and that's terribly phrased, but you know the point I'm getting at. The answer is absolutely not, to be honest, in a lot of ways. But I understand it.
That's great. That's a great answer, Lee. Yes. Yes.
And this is what I'm toying with at the minute. So what I've done is I was very unhappy at the start of this year. So I'd done the weekend, the New Year's Eve run at the stand in Newcastle, and that was absolutely wonderful. And I usually compare there, and I was doing a set and I was doing 20 minutes, and it felt so refreshing and alive, you know. I like comparing, it's, I guess, my bread and butter, but there's something wonderful about not having to care about the rest of the bill. And I don't mean as people, but not have to go, I'm setting the room up.
Sure. Rather than it's on your shoulders. If you're a decent, if you're a half decent compare, the night is on your shoulders.
Yeah, and I like that responsibility.
Responsibility, yeah.
And I genuinely like comedians. You know, like, I think certainly around here, my best friends are comics and they're wonderful people. But I also like to go, yes, 20 minutes. If this goes wrong, this is on me. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, and But that was sort of, I almost knew that once that was out of the way, I was going to be a bit down, because I knew January, and some stuff came, like it always does, but I knew January was quiet, and I had that thing of going, so I know I can do this, I've been pretty good at it for a while, but this felt like the last days of me being able to just do this, if that makes sense. Like, it felt like... And this isn't one of those, we've all seen it on Facebook with people I like, but have gone, oh, what is it? You get older, people don't want you anymore. But then the answer is, in a way, yes, that is how the world works. I'm not naive to that, you know? And I never had my, and again, this is my fault. I don't think fault's the right word, but this is, I understand it. I never had the time of being an exciting new act, you know, like some people have. I feel I had... Okay, Lee isn't very good. Then suddenly, oh yeah, Lee's fine. But I didn't go to Edinburgh early enough. I listened to all of that stuff, which I now don't believe of. Don't be going to Edinburgh until you're blah, 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 headlining every club or whatever. And I go, I think it's a different setup, frankly. I don't think that's particularly relevant. And I look at people who start at the same time as me, and we wouldn't have been the same. We're very different acts. But like, I started around the same time. I gigged a lot with people like Richard Gadd when he was new. And I would not have won an Olivier, don't mistake that. But Richard did the Fringe very early, built this thing, and I waited and waited and waited, and I wish I hadn't. I wish I'd have had some idea of going, rather than this, he has this act who we think is probably fine, and he's been going a little while, whatever. I feel like I missed out. But that was a long time ago, and I don't feel bad about that. What I do feel is that I don't always know what I want, if that makes sense. Like, I really value my independence. I like, that's a very important thing to me in terms of the work I do and just the life I live. But part of me also thinks, I do feel like I'm good enough to have a fairly decent agent or whatever it is. But I also don't think I necessarily, so I want the life, I don't know if I want to lead the life that they would want me to lead, for a start, although I would like more money. I'm not stupid. I was talking to a friend of mine, Louise Young. So Louise is from the same housing estate as me in Jarrow, and we were both pretty, let's say, pretty straight in circumstances. And I think Louise's, in fairness, were probably... I mean, even judging by the name of our show this year, she describes herself as feral, which is, you know what? She's not even, in some ways, she's not even over-exaggerating. She had a very tough upbringing.
Okay.
And I was sort of moaning to her, and then I got an opportunity for a thing that ended up not working out, but simply getting the opportunity to get something looked at that I didn't expect was a boost that I needed at the right time. But my immediate instinct was to go, oh, I'm not going to bother with this meeting. It'll be shit. If they think my thing's good, they're obviously idiots. And she sort of told me off, which is interesting, off someone 10 years younger than me. And she was right to go, you can't keep moaning about lack of opportunities. Then one comes, just pissing it away because you've got all this self-doubt. And I think I would say the reason I'm not where I feel like I could be in a best case scenario is myself, honestly. I do think I can do the job, but I do. I'm absolutely, and this is a realization I've come to recently as part of the ADHD thing. I spoke to Anya Atkinson, who's a comic around here, who you might know, I don't know, but she's got diagnosed, of course, and she was talking about rejection sensitivity. And I think that is, I've only recently realized it's kind of dominated my entire professional life, which is, I feel like a lot of the things I'm doing, which is going my own road and setting up things to, is actually just a fear that everybody secretly hates me and doesn't want us. You know, I think if I can, and it's not a, like, I have a lot of very good friends and stuff like that, but it's a constant fight against the feeling that they're doing as some sort of act of charity to me.
You
know?
Oh, mate.
Yeah. So
none of that presents itself from the times I've spoken, you know, or chatted to you or what have you. How does it manifest in you? Do you go dark? I've got a mate who just goes dark and you won't speak to anyone for 3 months and you need to kind of go, we're all in the habit of, like, we don't notice it anymore. And now we go, oh, he's doing that thing again. He's gone dark. Yeah. Is it someone check in on him, you know, because, like, he'll just withdraw.
No, what, I don't think I do. I don't think I do. I think so. I think I lie in bed till the afternoon and then get furious with myself. And then I'll get up, I'll send some messages to some friends or something, and then I perk up as the day goes on. Then my wife gets home from work and I'm just puppyish and really pleased to see her as a distraction. But I think, I don't think I lash out, but I think I've got this thing where maybe on social media I seem more aggressive than I am because I'm quite a sweet boy, but I suddenly get really frustrated at the wider world in ways that I can't change anything and go, I'm really angry with the king today. As if, like, yeah, of course you are, but what are you going to do about it? You know? Yeah. So I put, like, just, while at the same time getting really stressed if anyone answers in a negative way because I don't actually want an argument, I hate them. Mm-hmm. Well, this has all come out, hasn't it?
Thank you for sharing it. I kind of hit you with two quite big things quite early doors. I think that I think so much of it is chaos. So much of it is chaos, and so much of it is luck. And I don't, you know, there are meritocratic elements to it. We all apply ourselves to the hand we're dealt. We apply ourselves to the luck. And the last thing anyone wants to be is someone who, in your words, avoided becoming famous. I thought that was very well put. And then it's like this comes up from time to time on the show, I suppose. This idea that if you have made it and have become rich and famous, you've sort of earned the position of being able to look at it and go, that's all just shit and luck. But if you haven't, then it sounds like bitterness stand there and behold the chaos and go, well, obviously, if you get lucky early, if you win a competition early, which might be, and whether that happens or not, whether you have the opportunity to get to the final might depend on the smallest, slightest whim. You know, someone slammed a door and your name flew off the table. They're stupid, stupid micro decisions that are constantly happening to everyone. And the fact of not getting to the final and the fact of not getting the thing and someone else does and then they get the agent and they accelerate, that's a real tangible thing, the speed of that acceleration. So to feel like you kind of missed out on the arrival, like, you know, and I think you're being, again, if not humble, you're being very decent about it in terms of, like, I didn't go early enough and that's on me. You know, or I didn't take the risk, I didn't back myself, and that's on me. You have to not blame yourself, I suppose, but we all have to kind of own the decisions that we've made in that respect. That must be really, really hard. I suppose the point I'm trying to make is that it's so hard for any of us, no matter what our level of profile or success or any of those kind of any metrics, even our level of happiness, it's so hard to kind of go, what might have been? And what decisions did I make? And what decisions did I not make? So we all have to just kind of be and just exist and go, well, it is what it is. And I can either let it demotivate me and kill me off or, you know, keep going. And you're some... Go on.
It sometimes does. I suffer from massive bouts of demotivation. And again, I suspect it's an ADHD thing where I don't... What I find is I have a couple of days a month where I work intensely and put a lot of plans into place and spend the rest of the time going, oh, I'm now going to have to do that thing that I planned 100%. To do.
Yeah,
and I hate it. I hate it. And I hate it. No, I'll not name her because it's probably illegal, but a friend of mine, comic, recently diagnosed with ADHD, she got some hooky tablets from abroad for narcolepsy.
Okay.
And I've got to tell you, mate, she gave me some of them in case I needed them. And I worked for 15 hours and it was incredible. And I thought, is this what people are like? It's absolutely wonderful.
The Comedian's Comedian podcast cannot recommend this course for action.
I'll not name any names, but just get in touch with if you need it. But, where were we talking about? I got distracted. Owning our decisions, I suppose, and
my point is, it's like we all have to kind of. I'm pleased with the sentence. I'm going to say it again. We have to behold the chaos. You have to stand and look at like your career and the world and the things available to you to oneself. You know, and go, oh Christ, I have to fit into this somehow. And you'll and who knows what you could have done, and you know who knows what you could have done differently. You just I've got to still be here.
I refuse to not fight the frustration with that though, because chaos is how I'm best. And I've had a lot of people say to me, you do too many things at once, focus on one thing. And you go, yeah, if I could focus on one thing, I wouldn't be in this light. I would be very different. I can't focus on one thing. And I can only really work when I've seven things on the go and I don't put too much stock on one. And yeah, that's probably harmed my career in some ways, but I can't change the person I am. You know, like if I could, God, I work through procrastination, you know, that is how I write. And I think, so this is something I read once and I believe it, but I don't know if I believe it because it's how I already work, right? Which is that creative people procrastinate and it's a good thing. And I really believe that. So I think, I could never be one of those people who writes the Edinburgh show in September. And I'm glad about that because I'm writing it all the time, right, Stu? We're all obviously thinking, and comedy's for obsessives, right? It's all percolating. But it's the thing about once you've written your show down in whatever way you write it, whether you write long form or just notes, your brain almost stops working on it, and you can go back and you can work on it and you can try to add bits, but you're fighting against an already completed puzzle. So your brain's already satisfied.
Oh, God, that's exactly where I'm at the moment.
Yeah.
You just hit the nail so hard on the head. We're recording this at the end of mid-May, and that's exactly what, for the first time for years, I've written down my whole show. And now I feel like the puzzle is partly completed. It's not brilliantly completed. Some of the bits have been hammered in the wrong places. But it's a different sort of a challenge now. And I've been experiencing real inertia in the last couple of weeks and wondering why. And I think I'm doing exactly that.
Yeah, it's finished. Like, and you will change this show. Of course you will. But you're now chipping away with a puzzle, with a chisel at a massive thing of granite rather than, God, is this a metaphor? Hang on.
Pulling scarves out of a hat.
Yes, I suppose. Or just sort of roughly playing with some Play-Doh and it's all soft and malleable because you haven't really made anything out of it yet. You've got like, I don't want to say Michelangelo's David. I'm sure your show is fine, Stu, but come on, let's not oversell. But you know, like you've got a finished statue there and you're now making small changes to it. And it's kind of hard because it looks finished whether you feel it is or not.
I've got to burn the script. I've got to delete the script. But such a good point.
On the other hand, I mean, who's to say I'm right? I've seen some of my shows and they've been fucking half-finished messes.
No, but I think you've specifically... The Comedian's Comedian podcast is not suggesting anyone in mid-May burn their script. However, specifically with the situation I'm in right now, I think I have it has become a trudge, and it shouldn't be a trudge. It should be delightful. It should be, oh, look at all these, I've got all these puzzles. Oh, look at all these things I've got. It should be me spinning around on a gyroscopic chair going, oh, I could do any one of these things just now. And it isn't. It's me kind of hunched crying over a block of marble.
A block of David.
But, yeah. But crying over a tiny penis, which was apparently very attractive back then.
Yeah, which... So bear in mind, though, like, that it is a risky way to write a show. I'm not debating that. But I think I had it because I did my 2019, I think it was. I had a show that was just, it was awful. It was awful getting to July. And I thought, I cannot go to the fringe with this. And I almost wrote it off. And it was so refreshing to go, this show's rubbish, I'm just going to have fun. And then by early August, I was like, oh, this has become really funny. I was lucky it could have easily not become funny, but the premise that I had the show based on was just unsuccessful. And it was like, what's the point? I'm flogging a dead horse here. I had a very small room. I'm going to have fun with it. What I like to do is have a show where I do something different to what I did the year before. And I don't mean in a getting people in. I mean in a I want to get better. So I'm like, the year before I told true life stories, which was, it was a dead mother show because my mum had died. And I very much hate the cliche of going, oh, you're doing that, are you? And you go, yeah, but my mum's died. It is significant to us.
Yeah, how can you think about anything
else?
What am I
supposed to write?
It's an act of artistic cowardice to have a parent die and then do a show about anything else. Yeah. I'm laying my cards on the table.
Yeah. it felt like it is and I think I had a different outlook on it in that, I mean, this sounds bad, I know, but my mum died and we weren't as close as we maybe could have been. And while I was sad, it didn't ruin my life. Yeah. And that was sort of, and I did have people come to me after shows and go, oh, that happened to me and nobody ever talks about it. So that was, and.
So what, you're telling me at the 40 minute mark, you realised you didn't care your mum had died?
Well, it was, I got it in much earlier than that. I think I needed a lull earlier. No, and genuinely, if I had to say, if there was a routine I'm most proud of, it probably is that one, in terms of, I'm proud that I got a laugh, not just off that routine, I got a laugh off telling them my mum had died. And I think that was, oh God, that sounds horrible, I know. Like, I have to, most people listen to this are going to be comedians or big comedy fans. People understand that. Obviously, it's one way of looking at it. I was sad my mum died. I was in the room when my mum died. It was horrible. You do have that almost psychopathic thing of being a comic, don't you? Of going, oh, this is awful. Remember that detail. And you go, no, switch off, leave, be in the moment. Your mum's dying, you know. And it was a very strange thing. But she did say something very funny just before she died too, which has got to be relevant, you know. I was dead proud of the way I did that bit because I learned how to couch a sad bit or telling some people a sad bit in a bit of ludicrousness, which is, I think if you're doing it, for me, with my personality, I can't be harsh without a bit of protection around it because I look too cute or whatever it is. I come across as too likeable. So it's a bit like, oh, why is he saying this? But I was able to, so what I would say is I'll just do the bit. Okay, I'll do a short bit of the bit, the start, which is, I say, and I like to, sometimes people say, how do I say this bit? And my answer is often, just say the thing you're thinking. Yeah. You don't have to cleverly metaphor it in. So it was something like, this next bit's going to be sad and I don't want to make you sad because it's against the remit of what I'm here for. Yeah. So I was speaking to another comedian and I said, how do I do sad bits? Because they've done sad bits and I want to tell you this thing because I think it's important, but also I've got some jokes about it to be honest. And I said, he started going on and on because that's what comedians are like. They like to act like it's more than it is. thanks for having us on the
welcome
podcast.
Welcome to the show, yeah.
Yeah, the actual secret of comedy, everything, everybody is. If you say something funny in the laugh, say it the next time. And then he said, say something very surprising first, then slip the sad bit in. So I'm like, oh, that's good. Say something surprising, and then slip the sad bit in. So I said, so with that in mind, a couple of months ago, I saw Tom Cruise swallow an alligator whole and my mum died. And I think that's really... And I know some people would say it's a very weak way to get a heavy subject in. But to me, the fact that people laugh at the line, and my mum died, is like... Yeah. That's quite a proud thing, to be honest.
So this is Lee Kyle. Don't miss Disco Twix on YouTube. If this has piqued your interest, it's an incredibly quick way to get in touch with him and suss him out. I'm sure you'll love it. I really, really enjoyed it. His warmth just radiates out of him, and it's got some really, really funny and kind of abrupt and rude stuff in it as well, whilst being incredibly sort of warm and welcoming to all comers. Really, really good. So check out Disco Twix. And of course, his new show, England's Best Comedian, is on sale now for his run at the Edinburgh Fringe. Catch up with Lee at I'm Lee Kyle or imleekyle.com. My show is also getting ready for the Edinburgh Fringe, and blow me tight, I've found an ending to it at last. I found an ending that is buried in the beginning in the way that I love to have, which is, I don't know. Do you think the Aristotelian idea of tragedy being the end, tragedy having the end being buried in the beginning, is that just a callback? Was Aristotle just peddling some hackery? Who knows? But I'm really pleased with the ending. It's one of those things that this joke on the end of it makes me go, oh, that's now kind of retroactively shaping the stuff that goes before it. And I'm very chipper. I know you've been holding my hand as I've been through a very painful journey trying to make climate dread funny, but I think I have pulled it off. So you can catch up with all of my stuff, of course, at stuartgoldsmith.com, where you will find link trees to socials and links to my online special on YouTube and links to my Edinburgh show, Spoilers, which is 3:20 p.m. at the Monkey Barrel throughout the month of August in this year of our... I'm not going to say Lord, but our collectively evolving consciousness, 2023. So that's all of that. Let's get back to Lee just now. We will talk a little bit more at the end. And remember, you can go to the Insiders Club feed, which you can join for £2 a month or as much as you like at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to find out more about how Lee's mentality has changed regarding sending emails to promoters. And he also, while I take a little wee break, I didn't realise until I went back and checked the log for the episode, he also sang me a little song, which I think is the mark of a truly classy guest. Here's Lee.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I think there's something to be said for carefulness, you know, like it's so the whole, and I don't really want to get into the oh you can't see anything these days thing, because it's been debated endlessly and endlessly and endlessly, but I've always thought, yeah, you can't because you're shit. You know, like we've all been on bills with acts who can say some horrific things without any of the protection that I do it, but they're very good at it. And they've got a twinkle in the eye or an understanding of irony or 30 years experience or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't want to get into that because it's a done debate. I'm not interested in debates that are done anymore. Like, yeah. You know.
Tell me, Lee, what's it like being a woman in comedy?
Sexy.
Yes. I've got a cold fear now that people will read that as something other than me jokily pointing out that the what's it like being a woman comedy debate is a done deal and dead and no one should ask about it anymore. I think that's clear. But if Instagram Reels has taught me anything, it's that people will misunderstand literally any thought you could possibly have.
And they will run with an entire invented personality for you based on a line that you don't even feel strongly about.
Yes, I asked on Twitter, I think, about... Oh, no, it was on Instagram. It was about my seven-year-old and I. He wanted to watch Eurovision. And I said, look, I'm totally... Eurovision is completely alien to me. Is it suitable? And what I meant was, is it going to be sweary? Is it, you know, yeah. I know Graham Norton hosts it and apparently over a glass of wine. And is it suitable for kids? And someone sent me a private message lambasting me for my anti-LGBT views. Whoa. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, first, meet my son. But it was really staggering. So, yeah, okay, so... We won't get into that debate, and I'm more interested in you anyway.
Let's
talk a bit about the content of specifically of Disco Twix, because let's come back and talk about the content of Disco Twix. First, tell me where you're at with your show this year.
Well, based on what I've already said about, I have got a title.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Of course, you said it's
where I am.
England's best comedian.
I'm very puzzled about it, to be honest, in that I don't really know what it is.
This is the perfect time to talk to us about it.
Everyone
that hears this is now going to come and see it because we want to see what it turns into.
God, I could do with that. I think it's about rejection sensitivity, which is a new thing. But is it? What is it about?
Is what it's about, like, how much of it have you got? How many minutes have you got that you think, oh, that'll definitely be in? Like zero,
40? I don't know, Stu. I don't think like that.
This is my question. So how do you think? Like, are you starting with it's about? Are you starting with, hey, this is the stuff I find myself talking about at the moment? Maybe there's a show in there. How are you approaching it? How are you you've got your chisel in one hand and your hammer in the other. In what direction are you? Are you circling the marble? Are you throwing them away and rolling in Play-Doh? Where are we?
At the minute, I think this is where I am in terms of my current fear of rejection is my mind's not letting me think about it, to be honest. Which, luckily, it can't stop it because it is, but it must, God, it's at the back of my mind right now. I'm doing what I do, which is I'm doing a lot of other little jobs for other people rather than myself. Hoping it all somehow goes away is the actual truth.
Thank you.
And I'm starting, like I always start, with going into it thinking, oh, fuck it, I'll just do a best of. Because...
That's quite a healthy, I'll just do a best of. Then it's fun and it's playful and you're reminding yourself it's just plasticine, right?
Yeah, yes. And what that means is there's no pressure of a blank page. And what always happens, Stu, is that by the time I get to there, everything's new and it's not a best of at all. But I've already got an hour. That's what I can look at it as.
Yeah.
Go, well, I've got a show, so I don't need to worry.
Yeah.
Which is something I was telling somebody somebody around here was writing her first ever show and asked for a bit of advice. And she, before she did stand-up, she still is a singer as well, and she did some funny songs. I went, put the songs in. She said, I don't want to do funny songs. I was like, yeah, but if you put them in, you've already got half an hour and then you can take them out rather than add stuff to a blank paper. So at the minute, oh my God, it's a best of with bits of me veering between telling them I'm England's best comedian and telling them I'm an absolute worthless piece of shit. So what I do is I think I feel like I take massive career risks based on very little, Stu, right? To hide from the day-to-day contacting of promoters, which I'm finding very difficult right now for whatever reason. I've got this thing about satire, which I think I don't like it. And I think if you're going to do it, I don't like gentle satire because I feel like, this is not an original thought, it's a tool of the ruling classes, isn't it, to gently be poked fun at?
Yes. Oh, God, the first time must have been 15, 20 years ago where someone first said to me, oh, well, the thing about Have I Got News For You is it's a big pat on the back for the establishment.
Yeah.
And I kind of went, oh, God, I thought it was biting. Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, God, yeah, I suppose you're right. God.
So I almost didn't want to write a joke and I just wanted to say, I wished he died of COVID. So that'll do. I feel if you're going to do it, you've got to be vicious to people who you think are genuinely bad. I feel that's a legitimate response.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not a bit I do, but I love to see you do it. And maybe that's the point. Maybe that's the point of the bit, isn't it? That's comedian as pressure valve. You know,
it's not something I would have done until then. The whole point of this show is I wanted to say things I didn't feel necessarily comfortable saying because I wanted to do a show where I felt I was being 100% honest about what I thought.
Yeah.
So it was difficult for me. I really, really, really want people to like me. You know?
Just in terms of the want, what do you want in the writing of a show? How many shows have you written now? I feel like you've done 10. Have you done like 7 or 8?
Let me think. I think I've done, I don't even know, maybe 5, 6.
Okay, 5, 6.
The first one I ever did was just a one-off that I did and I didn't like it. But yeah.
So just talk to me about, you don't need to sort of go through them sequentially, but like, how has the want changed? Like, I remember doing my first hour of solo stand-up and I wanted to have done an hour. Like, I really was like, oh my God, I remember being a newer comic thinking, how could anyone ever do an hour? That's insane.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do an hour. And then as I wrote the hour, I wanted to kind of make a particular point or what have you.
Yeah.
From what you, obviously there's lots and lots of different ones. If the most recent one, if Disco Twix, the most recent take one at least, was about wanting to not pander to them or wanting to say the stuff you actually wanted to say. Yeah. How has that changed from the wants of the previous show?
I can go through that. So the first show, I specifically remember, so I did The Fringe in 2013 as a triple header, and I felt very lucky, to be honest.
Who was your triple header with?
With Cy Buglis, who I don't think you'll know.
I know the name.
I could talk about Cy for an hour, and he's there's so many stories that I couldn't possibly put out there because what a life that man has led, and in positive and negative ways. Right?
Okay.
And Johnny Pelham.
Oh, yeah, Johnny's coming up on the show. Yes, I can't wait. Yes. Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm seeing Johnny this weekend. We're both in Glasgow at the same time. He doesn't know yet, but I'm going to meet him for lunch. I haven't asked him because he doesn't know I'm there. But Johnny, in the past, we're going for lunch. And I love Johnny, and he's in some ways a different person to how he is on stage while being the same person. Like, I think people think he's constantly thoughtful and pensive, whereas he's got a wild side, as Jonathan. Yeah. And I didn't enjoy The Fringe that year. I felt very lucky that we did it at the Stand, and it felt out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But I also felt a lot of pressure because I've sort of misunderstood. So we would sort of fly her all day because I didn't want to let people down. And then I sort of realised this isn't actually working. It's just driving me to illness.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't. And it was also insisted that I went on last because Johnny didn't want to. And Cy, who was a talented man with a lot of flaws, turned up without the brand new set he was going to write and instead just had an act that would not work outside of Newcastle. Okay. So just compared the show instead and spent all of the money he borrowed off us at the bookies. It was great. And I remember watching Seymour Mace's show that year and feeling very jealous that he had done a thing where he was able to allow people into his world, and I didn't feel I could do that.
Yes, gotcha. Okay, yeah, I'm just saying that's the first time I've thought about you in the context of Seymour. And yes, you both have a kind of fondness for the absurd and, letting people into the world. Got it.
Yeah, and this is something that we probably won't have time to touch on, but it's something that fascinates me. We're both from South Tyneside as well, which I think is similar. And I feel like South Tyneside is certainly the northeast, but one of the in Britain in a weird way, like almost all of the comedians people think of as being Geordie comics are from South Tyneside, and I don't know why because it's a very odd, shy place, and I'm trying to figure it out. So I'm talking like Seymour, Jason Cook, Sarah Milligan, Chris Ramsey, even like going back years and years, Eric Idle's from South Shields, and I don't understand it. But anyway, so I watched him and I thought, I don't get the chance to do this because on the bad days, the gig's already bad by the time I go on and they're getting off early and I'm having to fill half an hour. On the good days, they're overrunning and I'm doing 7 minutes at the end. It doesn't matter what I do. So the first show was just me trying to get them in. But it wasn't hugely successful in that. And what I was actually doing was doing my first show, and it was all of the material I had in an order, you know. The second year, I tried to write a show. I had some of the funniest ideas I've ever had, right? And I tried to write a show that was just weird, but without a theme. And it wasn't until, oh God, I have to tell you this. So it wasn't until I did it in front of my grieving family after my mum died that I realised this show's all about death and panic about death. But I didn't write it. It was so I booked a show. I booked a lot of shows in. I tried to self-fund a tour and it was partly successful, we'll go with, on this show. And I wish I hadn't done it with this show because it was my weakest show looking back, which had 3 really good set pieces in and lots of workaday stand-up. And the set pieces were, and this sounds mad, Stu, like, it came from moments of inspiration. Like, one moment of inspiration, I had these 3 ideas in about 3 minutes and thought, this show's going to be a mate, and I didn't have another idea. So do you know the song Loving You, It's Easy Because You're Beautiful? So I had this thing where I wanted to do a bit where I answered lots of songs posed by questions posed by famous songs. So what I did is I got a whistling kettle. This sounds stupid. And I had it on a hot tub on the stage with me, and I had to measure out the exact amount of water each time to play for about 8.5 minutes, right? So I would have music playing, and there would be questions posed by songs, and I would answer those questions, and I would do little music-y bits. And then that song would play at the end, Loving You. And I would time it so it ended as the kettle whistled for the high note.
Oh,
yeah, and I thought, yeah, great. That was all I had. And it wasn't until I booked these shows in, and one of them was in the estate where I grew up, and I thought, there's not going to be that many there. It was more a community centre, and I thought, it'll just be interesting. And then my mum got ill and died while I was touring that show. And I was like, this is a bit grim, but they wanted to do the show to the point where they said, is it all right if Maisie, who was the mayor who lived next door to me granny, right, if she does a speech about your mum before the show? And I went, absolutely not. Like, come on now. No. No. And what I ended up doing was trying to take bits out of that show that I thought might remind them of my mum who died 2 weeks ago. And then I thought, it wasn't until I looked through it that I went, there isn't a show. This is all really fun bits about fear of death. So that was that one. The next one I purposely was writing about my mum dying, and it was I wanted to tell true stories, which I'd never done before. I wanted it to be I'd get better at telling stories. Then the one after, I wanted to get better at making up a story and having them half believe it was true, but know deep down it wasn't, which didn't really work. Okay. It was a funny show. It was the show I talked about earlier that I threw all in the bin, and I feel it was me most funny show, like bare bones funniness, but it was a bit of a letdown in that. I think I wasn't good enough at having that bit of going, oh, but this isn't quite true. And I think most people just believed it was true. And what I'd actually done is written a story where I came out of it looking great, which wasn't the intent. You know? And I was like, and then in the end, I was correct. And I'm like, oh, that's good. Like, oh, it didn't actually happen. And yeah, I couldn't quite get it to. So I did put a bit at the end where I sort of let the air out of the balloon and let them know that it probably wasn't true. But I never said, oh, it wasn't true. But I was a bit disappointed in myself in that way, but I think in terms of the laughs, there were some bits in it that I was like, I'm really, for a show that came together late, I was happy. And that gets us, I guess, to the point where we are, which is that last one was about just trying to be honest and remove that fear from myself of going, hey, don't worry about it. I know I said a thing. I'll not say any more things you might disagree with. You know, I wanted to remove that.
Yeah, okay. So I suppose those... What that kind of suggests to me is that's that kind of busy brain, that kind of restless quality that you were talking about earlier that I certainly have as well, which I you see certain comics who work out who they are and they do that and they do another show. Sarah Millican, you mentioned, you know, brilliant, brilliant comic, lovely person and very hard worker. This is what I do. And I'm going to do it about this. And then I'm going to do it about this. And then I'm going to do it about this. And as a result, consistency, building a crowd, always delivering, brilliant. I certainly, speaking for myself, way more restless than that. What do I want to do with the... How am I going to... It's like I feel like I've got a shed full of half-finished inventions. And I feel that's a little bit like what you've kind of described in going through that rundown of your shows and also...
Yeah, and it's... I would say in terms of building an audience, it has not been a positive. it's starting to happen slowly, I think, at least around here.
I would hope so, because I do think of you as someone who... There's a particular thing. Like if I saw your name amongst 15 comics at the Fringe and someone said, hey, who should I go and see? I could suss them and go, you'd enjoy Lee
but
Kyle. Do you know what I mean?
I feel like certainly from last year's Fringe, if they found us in the past, they've forgotten. it was really hard. Okay. But I think a lot of that was, in fairness, I found out later that I was pretty ill, pretty serious, like more seriously than I thought. Okay. So I was finding it very difficult to even build up the enthusiasm to do, because that was the show I did that you saw in November. I recorded it in November. And it was the same show, but it wasn't as good because I wasn't in the room in the way that I always am.
Yes. But also there are these other kind of factors that, like I say, when we're beholding the chaos, some of the factors are year on year, more and more and more acts. Year on year, more expensive rents, fewer punters in town, or fewer punters who are going to take a punt on a particular thing. I just noticed it then when I said, oh, there's you and 10 comics on a board. At Edinburgh, it's you and 3,000 comics on a board. So how, like, without... Because the way the festival works is always changing, the way the Fringe works is always changing, and the way that now it's become the place where you sell tickets to your social media followers rather than the place where you build an audience necessarily. You know, we're all happening during that. It's like that's the kind of the arc of the comet, and we're all kind of in it going, oh, right, how do I fit in? Oh, it's changed again. It's changed again, you know. And it's so easy to look, it's that confirmation bias at looking at people who appear to have done it well or got a successful result from it. And going, oh, can I copy what they did? You go, that's no, gone. The comic's already it's moved
done.
On.
Done.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know if that's solvable. And if it is solvable, I don't think it's solvable for someone my age. And by that, I don't mean the industry's moved on. I mean, people my age can do TikTok. And I've started doing TikTok, but I'm fully aware that it's not natural in the way it is for someone who's 18. I'm having to learn it like an old man used to have to learn the internet, and we'd laugh and go, oh, you can't even send an email. You know, it's an inevitable fighting against the tide, I guess, which you can't fight against. What I worry I've come across, and this is genuinely not the case, I'm really not bitter.
No, you know, I don't think you've come across bitter at all.
And I'm not jealous. I'm not, like, but I was. This, I think this is a thing that's important to me to say, that I think I've had times of being jealous of people, like I think we all have. Because inevitably you start, and then people who start after you, who you may or may not rate, become more successful than you. That is just how it is. That is how it is. And I've seen people who've been going longer than me, who that's eaten them up. Mm-hmm. And it's eaten, and I can't do that. So, again, what I try really hard to do now, and I think there'd be a number of people who would vouch that I do try to do this, is that I really try to help people. Because then you can't get jealous because their success is part of yours.
Oh, God, that's the secret of this podcast. I struggle terribly with jealousy. And I think that's a big part of why I like to help people. I love it when people go, oh, yeah, thanks, I was on the show and loads of people turned up in Edinburgh, for example. But part of it,
that would be useful.
Part of it, and may I say, you'll be promoted to being a super goldsmith if Lee tells me that you went to his show this year.
That's all I ask.
But precisely that's good. That's a good thing. Jealousy is a natural emotion to feel, and processing it not by becoming embittered, but by helping people, even if there's a tiny element of like, because then I feel that they're, you know, I can enjoy their success. I can enjoy their. That's a much better way of framing it.
And it is hard. It is hard. Like, you know, I always have pangs, even like with some of my best friends. If I see them doing a thing that I'm not doing, of course you have a moment of going, oh, for fuck's sake. Yeah. But then you go, well, I'm glad it's them, not people I hate.
I read a fantastic thing, a really good thought experiment for coping with feelings of jealousy. If you're jealous, I can't remember where I got this. If you're jealous of someone, you have to think to yourself, okay, well, I can have that, but I have to have their entire life forever. All of it, and I don't get to have my life anymore. And I think as soon as you think that, you sort of go, oh, that's preposterous. You know, of course I want my life, so I just don't get to have that particular.
Yeah, and like the truth is, it's that position of going, I should be working and making the most money and doing all of these things every night, but I also always want to be in with my wife watching the television. You know, and that's the thing that's, I think, what the thing that deep down, other than the rejection fear stuff, has stopped me from reaching out to various agents over the years is that, oh my God, I really like being at home.
Yes,
you know, I don't want to be everywhere all the time.
You want to make the decisions yourself, and you want to be able to say yes and no to things as you would normally do. So it's a big thing to then change. And that's part of getting older in comedy, isn't it? And getting used to the comforts of your life, the acceptance. Exactly, yeah.
But that combined with my current terror of sending emails, it's not a straightforward path into the big clubs in that case, you know, like it's not, which is why I've had to accept that. And I've sort of built my own sort of thing, I guess, you know, like there's loads of ways I'd like to change, but it's all a process, isn't it? It's all a... Don't get us wrong. If any massive agents are listening, give us a shout. We'll have a chat. But I don't know if I want you.
That's good. Hard to get. I like it.
I genuinely don't know. That's the thing. I genuinely don't. I want both sides, and you can't have both sides, and that makes things difficult.
Well, tell me about Feltnout. Tell me what Feltnout is and why it's called Feltnout. And we've got to wrap up pretty soon. So give us the potted history. Let's see. Like when you say doing your own things and working on your own stuff, maybe that's a good time to talk about it.
Okay. This is the thing more than anything is motivating me comedically at the minute, in that it's a very difficult thing to explain, I guess, because it's more exciting than I think I can make it sound to me. So it's something we set up in the pandemic, me and a few other comics. So once people might not know, like John Gibson, who is, and Neil Harris, who are around here. And by the way, go and see Neil's Edinburgh show, everybody. He went from being a boy who had the worst preview ever last year. Like, believe me, I was at it. It was horrible. In 20 minutes of nothing. In 2 months learning animation so you could do a show where he does a double act with a right-wing animated lion who's been fired from CBeebies for biting a kid.
Okay, yeah. So, great.
Yeah, you've got called Helpy. It's brilliant. So, plus some comics people will know, like Gav Webster and Lauren Patterson came on board, and we sort of set up during the pandemic a cooperative of, and the point is, any comic in the Northeast can join, and most do. So to get work from us, you have to live in Tyne, and we are County Durham and Northumberland. It's very strict. Yeah. There's way more great comics around here than people know, because one of my favourite things about comedy is the people who are brilliant locally but don't care enough about it. So you just have these hidden gems, and I love
what
that.
Is it? We've is got it so like many. An agency or a production company?
What is it? No, it's legally a community interest company, which means we have to do lots of work for the community. And the community is both the community of comedians to improve our lot, but also the community on a wider. And we're also legally a cooperative, so we're owned by our members, and we're the only one we think of our type in the world. And what we do is, a lot of it's about cutting out the middleman in comedy. So, you know, the people who, and these aren't all bad people, I'm not saying that, but the people that we give lots of money to for things that we go, well, we can do this. So, for example, there's comedians who can do so much, and we're lucky in that we have got ones who work in business. We've got Neil, who does tech, so he does all the tech stuff, and he set up our own ticketing system and things. We've got Sammy Dobbins, a photographer, so we get acts for £10 a year, their first ever headshots. So we've got a day soon with 16 newer acts who don't have headshots. They're coming and getting them done and edited, and they don't have to pay a penny for it. And we put on charity gigs, so we do gigs at the Tyne Theatre, who we've got in, which has allowed us to book acts in at the Tyne Theatre who would never do solo shows in a theatre. And so we've had, on International Women's Day the last 2 years, we've done gigs for Rape Crisis Tyneside Northumberland, who a friend of mine, the only friend I still really know from my teenage days, Dawn, works for, and she went, can you help us out? We want to do a gig in a 40-seater. And I said, well, let's see if we can book the Tyne Theatre. And we did, and my two favourite ever gigs, even though I wasn't on them, because they were just gigs, female stand-ups living in the Northeast doing them. Some of them well-known, some of them not well-known, but all brilliant. Like, and this year was so lovely. Like, it was hard in that we had to leave some off because some came through. Like, there's no room. And you think, this could not have happened 10 years ago because there was maybe four of them and two were decent. And it's like, it's lovely to watch all these great acts come through and watch people become quote-unquote stars to the local audience. So there's the last, Nicola Mantaglia, so I don't know if you know, who does a character called Zoe, who is my favourite comedian, which is weird because she's a friend, she's someone I've started with. And I honestly think she's the best act in Britain right now. And it's extraordinary.
Go on, Nicola Mantaglia.
Yeah, like, it does a character called, which if I describe to you, wouldn't sound as funny as it is. And she dresses down, which I love, right? She used to go on stage looking very beautiful and pretty, whereas now she looks a mess by on purpose. Okay. And she does a character which sometimes, and I have to defend her for this, some people who don't know this archetype think she's almost playing disabled. She isn't. What she's playing is the sort of women you get in Jarrow Council estates who are thick but certain of themselves.
Okay.
So she's the cleverest person in any room. It's incredible because she looks and talks as if she's stupid. So she does get a lot of hecklers, but then just kills it within a second. She's like, you can't compete.
Okay, all right, I look forward to that.
And after her going on last at this theatre show last year, because all the acts, even the ones who were more experienced, like Louise, not more experienced, but had played bigger gigs, mm-hmm. Louise Young and Lauren Patterson and stuff, mm-hmm. went, no, she's got to go on last, she's the best. And it was lovely to watch them all at the side of the stage, almost like children, just watching. Watching them, just going, this is lovely. And when she came on this year, as the last act before the break, I've never heard a buzz for an act like it. Like the whole theatre, I was like, oh, it's her. Mm-hmm. And it's just been great to help build a thing for these talented people on this scene who I think should have more.
So it's like a cooperative agency, but not quite an agency. It's, but sort of a cooperative, self-starting collective, basically.
Yeah, but it's really like, it's really sprinted away with us. We thought we might get one monthly gig somewhere, and people are coming all the time. I had 5 venues come on Friday going, can we do a gig, please? And it's like, yeah. Amazing. But more than anything, it's been lovely to just watch. Like, I'm not going to pretend everyone in the Northeast best of friends. Let's not be naive. But everyone just mostly go, I can see the benefit of this. But in fairness, like, I do give myself a decent share of the word comparing them, because I have to, otherwise I can't afford to do it. But okay. I don't think, like, without blowing my own trumpet, I don't think there's any acts in the Northeast who don't think I'm good enough to do it. It's not a case of, like, going, I'll compare them because I'm shit. I think they would go, you would be one of them anyway, you know. But it's, and we work on, like, podcasts with people, so we'll put every Monday together make podcasts with people who want to make them, and just loads of stuff. Patreon.com/feltnout, everybody. It's, please.
Why Feltnout, by the way? Tell me why Feltnout. Tell me why Feltnout, and tell me briefly, because I want to hear the very last thing we've got about 2 minutes left, is I want to hear about your solo Royal Rumble. So tell me why Feltnout, because I need to know.
Okay, Feltnout was, we wanted to have something that was resonant of Geordie comedy, but not like, aren't we canny, I hate all that. Oh, it's Newcastle great shit. Feltnout was, do you remember The Tube?
The TV show.
There was a very surreal, I think comedians almost pushing it, but comedy odd thing called Wavis O'Shave on that, who was also from South Shields. And he played a Geordie stereotype character who would hit his knee with a hammer and go, I felt nabbed. So he wanted to call it that because it was a bit punker.
So tell me then about your solo Royal Rumble.
Okay.
And then I'll ask you if you're happy and then we'll get out.
Okay. Happiness fits and starts. Royal Rumble. So the Royal Rumble, for those that don't know, it's a 30-man wrestling match. And the most famous one is the 1992 Royal Rumble, right? That is the one that is just, it has just enough different characters in so they could all have recognisable costumes. And I did it at a festival in Newcastle that doesn't exist anymore called Jestival, which was in a big tent on the quayside. It was lovely. Yeah. And I said, can I do this? And I play all 30 characters in that match while the entrance videos played. So people enter every minute and a half, roughly. I got 30 costumes and wrestled myself. I set up a ring made out of chairs and line from a washing line. Okay. And it wasn't until I sort of got out there, the first two costumes, and had to start wrestling, and I thought, what do I actually do for an hour and 8 minutes while the commentary plays over? And the entrance bits were fun. I could run off and that would get a big cheer. And then I was like, but the wonderful thing was, a lot of my family came, right? That's not wonderful, because I was like, this isn't my show, this is a different thing. And they went, why don't you just do your show? I went, I'm doing this. And there was a lovely bit where I think I got them, because I was being Ric Flair at this point, right? And I heard my granny say to me, auntie, she went, I think he's going to win.
Oh, that's lovely.
And you know what? He did. But people have asked if I can do similar again, and my health is at such a case where the answer is no, I can't. Oh. Absolutely not. Oh, I've always wanted to do it as a one-off at the Fringe, but I'd have to perk up fitness-wise quite a lot. To do it again.
Fair dues. Thank you.
Thank you, mate. It was really nice having you. It's nice to pontificate, and I know I get rambly, and for that I apologise.
No, you didn't pontificate than I asked you to.
Thank you. Fuck you, Stu. I'll see what I like.
Yes, there we go.
You can't say anything these days with the walks.
The podcast has been a success, and we finally got to the real Lee Kyle. And we're going to join the Patreon for Feltnout and support that if we're in the Northeast and we want to support it.
We'll take your money from anywhere, honestly.
Take the money from anywhere. We're going to, your DMs are open on Twitter, at I'm Lee Kyle.
I'm Lee Kyle. Yeah.
I'm Lee Kyle. Yeah. And your DMs are open for suggestions about your rejection sensitivity dysphoria.
Yeah. Also, I forgot to mention, it's not on sale till June, and I can't remember when it is, but it's April or May next year. I've got a show at the Tyne Theatre, and I don't have the fan base for it, so please.
Right. Great, lovely.
Okay, it's one of my pointless risks when I do two things at once.
Very nice. And is that that's LeeKyle.com?
I'm LeeKyle.com.
I'm LeeKyle.com. You think? Yeah. He believes he knows the name of his website. And finally, your Edinburgh show is called, is it England's Best Comedian?
England's Best Comedian, Peartree, 12:45.
Peartree, 12:45.
I'm sure it will be a show by then.
Great. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you, Stu. Thank you.
So that was Lee Kyle. 20 more minutes with Lee on the content of Disco Twix, some wrestling with gender identity in his extremely gentle way. And which is not to say the punchlines are gentle. The punchlines are massive, but the warmth is so gentle. He's just such a twinkly guy. I just love him to bits. So I hope you will check out his show, England's Best Comedian, at the Edinburgh Festival this year. And my own show, of course, is called Spoilers, and I don't believe they clash. So why not make it a twofer? Speaking of Edinburgh, let's do Edinburgh chat in the postamble. For now, extra bits and bobs in the Insiders Club with all the extras from all the shows that have had them. We currently have episodes in the can for you with Lucy Beaumont, Gianmarco Cerezi, and Jeff Shaw as well, which is an amazing comedy history lesson. Also Johnny Pelham, which is wonderful. I've got loads of people lined up, and it's all systems go. Right. That is that for now. Catch up with Lee Kyle at imleekyle.com and Twitter, I'm Lee Kyle. Catch up with me at stuartgoldsmith.com, and you can find out all the bits and bobs I'm doing. If you are in any way connected to the corporate world, I can come and talk to you about resilience from the point of view of comedians, or indeed a comics view of the climate crisis, in which, if you're a director of sustainability, I smuggle in your climate messaging to my stuff. Nice, right? So if you know anyone who has those kind of roles, then send them my way. Lots of stuff. If you check out, why not check out stuartgoldsmith.com? It's so shiny and I put so much work into it. And like, I've done it in a very satisfying way, like I've done it myself. So if you haven't noodled around there, go and noodle around there. I think you'll go, oh, look at all this stuff. So that's nice. Right, that's us. Extra stuff at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And I will post amble at you in just a moment after this noise of a horse. Old school post-amble content now. I drove to Falmouth and back on, I'm going to say Monday. Lovely room if you're in Falmouth. Go to Toast. I think it's called, is it called Toast at Falmouth? That would kind of be hateful. I think it's Toast of Falmouth, which I think is better. But the room itself, you're performing it. It's like a brilliant little, it feels underground despite not being underground. And you're performing in front of a fantastic kind of graffitied art octopus with a monocle. Yeah, you check out the Instagram post at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. It's an absolutely beautiful place with a really lovely crowd. And thank you. I met a bunch of newer comics there who did kind of, there were some people doing open mics and stuff. And then bless their hearts, they all sat in the front row during my preview and guffawed to the extent that it became a challenge because I was kind of doing that without wanting to tread on that Stuart Lee mixed ability audience thing. It was one of those situations where some people are loving it so hard, you kind of wish they'd shut up a bit, because, with all due respect to you lovely boys who I spoke to, you kind of wish they'd pack it in or turn the volume down a little bit, because everyone else can sometimes react. If one group in the room is really loving it, everyone else can sit back and go, well, come on, it's not that bad. But nonetheless, very, very satisfying. Although, and this is sort of a warning, really, if you're in your 40s, don't, and you're a comic, or anyone doing long drives in the middle of the night, don't forget that you're in your 40s, because I think I forgot I was in my 40s and I drove from Bristol to Falmouth and back, and it took 4 hours and then 3 hours 45 because of road closures on the way back. And that's an insane amount of time to be driving. And I coped with it and I was safe, and then I got home and fell asleep, and then I woke up the next morning and I was so sad I burst into tears. So that's some old school. That's weird, isn't it? We were talking about vulnerability in this episode, but I think that is some quite old school. I've got a bit about this in the new show, maybe in the new show, just about the membrane between realities. Right, come with me now on a 4 minute post-amble head squeeze. Do you know when you're feeling pretty chipper and there's maybe difficult stuff that you're coping with in your life, but you're feeling chipper, so you're like, hey, I can cope with this, or that's a pain, but I'll deal with it later, I'm okay. And so that sort of feels like it equals being okay. And then
when you are feeling very low, when all of your, you know, all of your self-defined red flags and alarm bells are going, go, oh, I'm behaving like this again. That probably means I'm feeling sad. And you think to yourself, oh, yes, I'm physically exhausted. That's a big trigger for me. Of course, I'm sad. Do you find that you don't know which is the real one? Because when you're feeling sad, you don't think, I don't think, oh, well, you know, I've not slept enough, so I'm feeling sad, so I'm not seeing all this straight. I think this is the base reality. I can't cope, and the rest of the time I'm just pushing through it. But this is the reality, I can't cope. Isn't that weird? Isn't that annoying? I promised you 4 minutes is a minute and a half. I think I've said everything I need to say about that, other than asking you, do you do that too? Tweet me, unless you're feeling too vulnerable. What did I put on Twitter recently? I can't say the thing I was looking at because it pertains to a potentially massively important to me and this podcast guest who I may have someone I've been trying to get for years, but I'm not going to hex it. I may already have hexed it. I think I told the Insiders Club on the Slack app, the Slack channel that we have, and already I'm regretting that because I feel like I've hexed it. But I've got someone very, very important to my understanding of comedy and how it works.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
And I was researching them and I researched a thing that they do. Again, I'm being woolly, so you can't work out who it is. So I don't feel like I'm hexing it. God, this is pathetic. And in researching them, I got really sad. And I think I tweeted something like, it made me realise that so much of the time, because I'm a big fan of comedy, despite having arguably overdone it in my interest in comedy. I'm a big fan. And yet what I sort of realized is a lot of the time I watch comedy. I find it exhausting to watch comedy because a part of me is constantly comparing myself to the comic, comparing my technique, my kung fu to the comic's kung fu, you know, comparing my place in the industry that doesn't exist, comparing my success to theirs, all of this stuff. Whereas, you know, like we've said and thought about a million times, you can't just be jealous of someone. What's that? It's a great technique I cribbed off someone recently. If you find yourself being jealous of someone, think, would you swap, though, with them forever? Would you permanently swap? And as soon as you think about it being permanent, you go, well, no, of course, I want my kids and my wife and my life and my life. But nonetheless, it's still... It just basically, what I realised was, I'm just in the habit of exhausting myself by... constantly doing compare and despair. Who was that? It was Emma Willman. This came up in the Facebook group recently, and I couldn't remember who it was, but it was Emma Willman said in a recent episode, brilliant episode, go back and listen to that one. She said that she paid for some therapy, and the therapist said, well, compare and despair. And she walked around going, God, my God, this is the best therapist ever, without realizing that is a fairly tried and tested thing to say. So that, yeah, I can see that logically, of course, that's nonsense, doesn't do me any favors. But I think I don't notice the extent to which I'm comparing and or despairing in the background. And so I end up finding watching comedy a lot of the time unpleasant or painful. Or rather than actively deciding against it, I just kind of opt out quietly without noticing why. Do you do that? There must be things in your life where you do that. You sort of realise, oh, if I'm honest with myself, the reason I've done behaviours X, Y, Z, or I've omitted engaging with thing A, B, C... is that you... I ran out of letters then, had to go back to the beginning. Is that you think to yourself... You don't think to yourself. On some unconscious level, you could probably admit to yourself you are sort of subconsciously thinking, if I do that, I'm just going to spend the whole time going, I'm not as good as this. So you don't bother doing it. What a twat. There we go. That's my new that's my new self-analysis catchphrase. What a twat. Well, there we are. That's closer to the time I promised you. That arbitrary promise I made. I do recommend you see Disco Twix. It makes me smile to think of it. I have a lovely warm feeling towards that. I've said warmth about eight times. I think Lee's warm. So That's that. Yes. Right. More onwards and upwards. Onwards and sideways, at least. More stuff, more gigs, more previews. Come and see them. The if you go to stuartgoldsmith.com/comedy, there will be a link there that you find the link tree, which then blossoms with all of the up-to-date previews, which are, why don't we just bloody say them while we're at it? All of the, I can get to it in four, that was four button presses and a bit of stalling. What we have coming up is on the 13th of June, that's next week as I record this, that's 2 North Down in London. On the 28th, I'm at a Block in Plymouth. And then July, the 1st, I'm at Chippenham Comedy Festival. That'll be brilliant. The 2nd, I'm in Bristol at Redcatch Community Garden. That's a charity gig. The 4th, I'm in Exeter. The 7th, I'm in Swindon at the Hop Inn. The 9th, I'm at the Comedy Crate Festival in Northampton. Again, an amazing place to spend all day watching loads of preview shows. The 11th, I'm in Leamington Spa at the Lounge. The 13th, the Comedy Box in Bristol. 14th, Cheltenham Laughter Hours. Oxford Comedy Festival on the 15th. Bath Comedy Festival on the 17th of July. 18th, I'm at Chops in Bristol. And the 19th, I'm at Stooges Comedy in London. So come and see one of those. I think that's might be too many. I don't want to overcook it, but it isn't cooked yet. So you can't make the not overcooking it decisions until it's cooked. That's my advice to you. Next weekend, I'm going to attempt to make a vegetable curry for 12 people, which, if you know me at all, you'll know is really outside my wheelhouse. But I'm leaning into it as I grow in age and attempt to re-decide who I am. Apparently, I'm the kind of guy that borrows a massive Creuset cooking pot and cooks a curry for an absolute ton of people. So I'll fill you in with that as we go. Bye for now.